Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all, as happy as we can be under the present circumstances where the whole world seems to be raging against Israel. Anti-Semitism is widespread, definitely more widespread than it was at the outset of the Second World War, which of course led to the Holocaust. There is news out of Israel today that actually out of Qatar and Damascus, that not only has Hamas offered a new ceasefire deal, but that Nasrallah has seen it and approved it, and that both Gantz and Netanyahu are in favor of it. Anytime you're in favor of something that is supported by Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas, you are clearly on the wrong side. And this notion that anything that causes the hostages to come home is something that we will support shows the grotesque immorality that has swallowed Israelis. Make a move that sets yourself up for a far worse attack than October 7th to save maybe 50 lives, and I don't think it's that many. I would suspect that there may be 40 Israelis that are still alive in Gaza. But let's say there's 50. Is it a good move to sacrifice 5,000, 50,000, 500,000 for 50? Because that's the game you're playing. You know, for one Israeli soldier, Israel released over 1,000 Islamic terrorists. The head of Hamas was among them. Whom Israel had done great favors by saving him. He had a heart condition. And what did it cost them? We're to the point now where Israel's very survival is at stake. There's so much anxiety and angst against Israel and its defense of itself with all of the false Islamic propaganda that the very survival of Israel is at stake. And we know what happened the last time an anti-Semitic world came down on Jews when there was no place for them to escape. And that's the game that progressives in particular are playing.
Mm-hmm.
They're isolating themselves so that the only place for them will be the gas chambers again. That sounds harsh, but it's true. And so this notion that we will negotiate with terrorists and we will reward them with terms because we love our people and that's just who we are, we're going to save our hostages, is insane. Morally reprehensible. You know, to some extent, it's a game that the world has played many times over. One of the most grotesque escapades on this was when the United States was asleep at the switch, somehow missed all the significant signs and left Pearl Harbor open to attack. And once the Japanese had killed some 3,000 American Navy personnel, that we sacrificed 350,000 American lives to avenge that attack. That's not victory. It's grotesquely immoral. That's insane. And that's a mild version of the game that Israel's playing. On top of that, there isn't the realization in Israel or anywhere in the world that you can't negotiate with a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Muslims have an entirely different type of morality because the religion was based upon Allah, who is Satan, who was admittedly a terrorist and a sadist. He, over 1,000 times in the Quran, talks about his entertainment is going to be torturing everyone who doesn't capitulate to them. And his tortures are grotesque. And Muhammad was a sadist. He was a mass murdering terrorist. He was a rapist. He was a pedophile. He was the most reprehensible man, maybe who ever lived. The Quran is a disgusting book. It's a book of a death cult.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the Quran and Hadith, not only does Allah lie and does he commend lying, he tells Muhammad, you can lie all you want, doesn't matter. And then Muhammad says, eh, if I find something better to say, I'll renounce my vows and go with that. And so it is a religion of liars for liars. And when you're in that kind of a situation, and particularly when one of the most famous episodes in the history of Islam is the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where Muhammad himself renounced that he was a messenger, where he announced that renounced the idea that Allah was even a god, all because he got cold feet and he came to what really is Petra, but Kaabaville, with an insufficient force and was afraid that he would not prevail and that the Quraysh, who were far more articulate and reasonable and moral in Petra, would do what they had done previously, which was to convince Muslims that Muhammad was an idiot, that Allah was Satan, that they should not be devoting their lives to terror and murder on behalf of the devil. And so he got cold feet and he signed an agreement that said that he wouldn't terrorize them, wouldn't abduct their children, wouldn't rape their women, wouldn't plunder them for 10 years. And in the process, signed the agreement, renouncing that he was the messenger and renouncing Allah is a god. And, of course, the next breath out of Allah's mouth as a recital in the ninth surah, it begins by renouncing all vows and saying that any agreement formed between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. Go ahead and kill them. Slaughter them. And they went back and did so. But in the intervening weeks with The Muslims who had followed Muhammad to Petra, Kaabaville, to the point of death, complaining that their lives were now ruined and that they couldn't believe that they were leaving without plunder. They had come to rape the Quraysh women, plunder the wealth of the Quraysh, and to slaughter them, because in Islam, murder is a blood sport. And so Muhammad, like all robber barons, was in a terrible fix. Genghis Khan faced this constantly, which is that once you base your economy on thieving and the slave trade and on satiating the carnal desires of your militants with rape, and you stumble and go through a period of time where there is no plunder, there is nothing to rape, there is no one to kill, they will turn on you and kill you. And so what did Muhammad do? He did what he had done three times previously. He found the easiest prey in the region, the last Jewish community, Kabar. It's where the line Allahu Akbar was conceived, to say that Allah is greater than the God of the Jews, Yahweh. And for a matter of weeks, they besieged Kabar, raped every woman, enslaved every child, murdered every man. That's what they did. It wasn't the first time, it was the fourth time they had done so. They perpetrated genocide on the Jews in Arabia, tens of thousands of them. And if you don't think it's appropriate to declare war on Islam, well, I'm here to tell you, they declared war on you. The Islamic era begins with the Pledge of Aqaba. The Pledge of Aqaba is that we pledge to wage war on all mankind. And there's extra prizes awarded those who kill Jews. In Gaza, everyone is a Muslim. There is no one that is innocent. There's no one that you could consider a civilian by the standards of Islamic terror. Hamas is just a surname to this group of Muslims. That is why it's impossible to rid Gaza of Hamas. It's what I said 9 months ago, before Israel invaded, to say that the stated goal is impossible. It cannot be done. And now, even though you're hearing platitudes of, yeah, they've lost their ability to fight, we've got them where we want them. Bull. That's just not true. And the game of religion, particularly death cults like Islam, for every one you kill, you manufacture 10 more. And Israel has done that worldwide. And the reality is that there are no innocent civilians. The women in Gaza were manufacturing plants for future terrorists. A child in Gaza is a young viper. What percentage of young vipers turn out to be adult vipers?
I think that's all of them.
It's all of them.
100%.
And vipers are toxic. They're deadly, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You ever met a viper that was peaceful?
No.
No. And there is no chance that any young boy growing up in the Islamic culture like that is going to be anything else but a Jew-hating, terror-loving, woman-despising Muslim. If you don't understand that Islam is a death cult, that rape is condoned, that Muhammad was a disgusting pedophile, that they were mass murderers and thieves, and funded Islam on the slave trade, then you're ignorant. You ought not voice a stupid opinion and pretend that it's not fair to condemn Islam when Islam is the problem. Now, Islam's not the only problem. Israel, by failing to acknowledge that there is no such thing as a Palestinian, is part of the problem. Because they've allowed this lie to take root and grow, where you tell somebody there's no such thing as a Palestinian, there is no place called Palestine, and, you know, here the rhetoric out of Gaza is that there'll be no foreigners in Gaza, it's the Palestinians will self-govern. Well, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. There hasn't been one in 2,300 years.
Mm-hmm.
And even when the term was conceived, it was a myth perpetrated by Hadrian, who was busy crucifying and torturing Jews. And to buy into a lie of a mass murdering thug like Hadrian is just revolting. It shows anybody that uses that term just how stupid you are, how easily you're misled, and at great consequence, because the world's going to impose a Palestinian state when there is no such place, never has been, and there are no such people. And even with Hamas, you know what the name means in Hebrew?
Violent.
Terrorist. Violent, cruel terrorist. That's partly because every word, including the alphabet in Arabic, is the bastard child of Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the Quran is the bastard child of the Talmud, because rabbis sold Talmud recitals to Muhammad. But this is the fix that Israel is in, and now you have Gantz and Netanyahu and weekend at Bernie's all touting this new ceasefire plan, which Israel will sacrifice the lives of probably hundreds of thousands for 50 or less.
It's tragic.
One of the great, you know, it's such a travesty in judgment. And
yes,
and it's for a means of fighting a battle that had no chance of success. So I don't care if they were to have eliminated every Palestinian Muslim in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Place was a hellhole. It was a parasitic hellhole. It was living off the funds transferred by the European Union, the all-rich Gulf states and the United States. And so they had some pretty nice digs there, but there was no freedom. Hamas ran everything. If you stepped out of line and tried to stop the Hamas thieving among their own people, you were tortured, killed.
Mm-hmm.
There was no life. The greatest thing that could be done for them, if you could rid them of Islam, would be to rid them of Hamas, but that just isn't going to happen, and there's no one's going to step in from an Islamic country to try to govern Gaza with Hamas still there.
Right.
No chance. So it's just like so many mistakes that are made around the world. People start wars not recognizing there's really no way to get out of them. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Somalia. Look at Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Look really at North Korea.
North Vietnam, yeah.
North Vietnam. Yeah, we start wars without any idea how we're going to get out of them, and typically we sacrifice blood and coin for nothing. And that, of course, is what Israel is doing. And there were five things Israel could have done differently on October 8th, but did not do. And on October 8th, we shared all of them on this program and said, if Israel, if you do not do these things, this is your future, and we laid it out. And now as I've gone through and translated more of Yoel, which we'll get to shortly, Also, Hosha. Yahweh lays out exactly what awaits Israel. And it's dire. And, well, they aren't the ones who are raping and slaughtering and torturing, abducting, enslaving Jews. Their policies are responsible for making Jews vulnerable. Yahweh knows what to hate, when to hate, how to hate, and his people don't, nor do most people around the world. You know, for example, Israel in this most recent round of negotiations sent the head of Mossad to do the negotiation. His name is Barnea. On October 8th, in my open letter to Israel and on this program, I said, there's a man that has to be fired. Your head of the Mossad, when their newspapers knew what was going to happen and published stories about it, when low-level intelligence officers all the way up and down the ranks were writing memos and distributing them saying, sound the shofar, we're about ready to be attacked. And it's imminent, and it cannot be stopped, so at least let's be prepared. Your head of the Mossad, and you don't know it, and you don't prepare Israel for it, and you let it happen, you not only have to go, there needs to be a tremendous price for that kind of failure of leadership. You know, head of the IDF, same thing. Gallant as head of the civilian head of the military, same thing. They had to go that day. I would have also said that Netanyahu should have also fallen on his sword and said, the failure stops with me as well. Unfortunately, Israel just doesn't have a leader qualified to replace him. Not by a long shot, and certainly not by any of the gaggle of goons that are trying to run circles around his political carcass. And so Israel's in quite a fix. And so all we can do is warn Yisraels and Israelis and Yehudim who are willing to listen as to what's going to happen and what they need to do if they wish to be spared from this onslaught. We have entered the prelude of the time of Israel's troubles. It's one of the most frequently discussed prophetic topics throughout the prophets. And it becomes essentially unbearable with the establishment of the Fakistanian state, the final solution, if you will occur most likely in the late spring of 2026. And the next 7 years are going to be like none other in human history. And Yahweh makes this very clear that what Jews are going to endure between 2026 and 2033, the last 7 years prior to year 6000 Yah, is going to be worse than anything that they have ever endured. And when you consider the nature of the Assyrian brutality, the Egyptian enslavement and brutality, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, even before them, the Philistines. You consider, you know, the three attacks, invasions by Rome, what the Roman Catholic Church did to them, the horrors of the first Muslims starting in the 7th century as they perpetrated genocide on Jews. And then the Ottoman Empire, when the Mongols, Muslim Mongols, invaded what is now Turkey and created the Ottoman Empire, which was a monstrous Muslim machine. And, of course, in the hostile confines of Europe, Jews were so badly abused by Europeans, European Christians in particular. You know, from Russia to Portugal, and from the Ukraine to Poland, and all places in between. The Nazi Germans were a significant player, but they weren't the worst actors in Europe. And we're experiencing a higher level of anti-Semitism now in Europe than at the prelude to the Holocaust. So there is only one way out, and you're only going to find that one way out through the five things that I begged Israel to do on that tragic day of October 7th, which we predicted. I wrote about it in one of the books. I think it was in Coming Home. Precisely what Muslims were going to do with the aerial assault, the aerial bombardment, followed by the invasion of jihadists into smaller communities, and how they would hold the people hostages while bombarding the larger cities. And what happened on October 7th is 1% or even less of what's going to happen in the very near future. So you're warned again, Israel. And the kinds of things that had to happen was that collectively the nation needs to return to Yahweh. You need to stop this gross division where you're a house divided, where you have some 40% of Jews who are out of their mind progressives that are spewing all manner of nonsense and are counterproductive. And then you have 40% of Jews who are fundamentalist religious wackos, so deeply entrenched in Judaism that they wouldn't know the truth if it hit them between the eyes, have no clue who Yahweh is, no understanding of the Mikra, no understanding of the covenant, no understanding of their of prophecy, no idea who the Son of God and Messiah are. None. They don't know what happened on Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim in year 4000 Yah. They do not know what's going to happen as Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah are fulfilled between 2026 and 2033. They're clueless, but they're very dangerous and an exceedingly hostile force and hostile sense of parasitic influence in Israel. And so Israelis, if to have any hope, you need to be among those who are neither overtly political, particularly progressives, nor overtly religious. God has no interest in engaging with either. Come to know his name. Come to know the name of his son, the Messiah, Dod, the returning king, understand what he did in the fulfilling of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, understand what Yahweh was offering on the harvest of Shavuah, on Teruah, and his return with his son on Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, which is 2033. You don't have much time left, and it's going to get very rough between now and then. So the first thing you can do is accept Yahweh, come to know him. Constantly and continually, proudly, boldly proclaim his name. Come to understand how important his relationship is with Dod and what they have accomplished together. Understand and accept the five conditions of the covenant so you can receive the benefits, actually understand the purpose of each of the seven Moed Mikre and how they are related to the benefits of the covenant. This is step one. If you're interested in those things and forming a relationship with Yahweh, being part of his covenant family, entering eternity with your God, being saved by him, being part of his eternal family, you'll find everything you need to know at yadayah.com. I wish I could tell you you could also buy the books, but you can't. Amazon is filled with progressives. A progressive whose first name is Mohammed decided he didn't want us to be there anymore. And Amazon, that has a 91% market share of
distribution,
print-on-demand books, and an 85% market share on the sales of all books worldwide, a total monopoly, is run, and their book department is run by entirely irrational, grotesquely immoral people, whom there is no way to reason with. And so anyway, our books will soon be dropped there. We have no ongoing relationship with them. Fortunately, I had a nice discussion today with Yoel. He's going to work to create a Yada Ya bookstore that we will be able to arrange all of the content, and that the fulfillment will be handled by one of four or five print-on-demand sources that Jackie is currently reviewing.
Awesome.
We will offer softback books again, and we're going to engage in a relationship likely with Apple on ebooks. Over this short period of time. And of course, our commitment has always been to offer our books freely, comprehensively, in a credible and easy to navigate website, and David has done a marvelous job of that. The books are all presented on the shelf by category. They're very easy to search, either by verse or by topic. They are exceedingly easy to read. You can read them on any device. We ask nothing in return for them. They are there in their entirety for you to read. And so we would encourage that. That is why they are there. And Yahweh has a great deal to say about what we are doing in this regard. So the second thing is that to resolve the hostage situation, there was only one way to do it. You can't trade hostages, not even one for one, because the Muslims that are in Israeli jails were all convicted in reasonable courts of terrorist crimes. They cannot be released for an innocent person who was kidnapped. That's not moral. That will simply encourage more abducting and kidnapping. So there was no way that you could prevail that way. There was no way that you were going to prevail with all of the tunnels and with all of Gaza. Here, the last captives were actually in, quote-unquote, civilian homes. With all of Gaza providing cover for what the most fundamentalist Muslims were doing, there is no way you were ever going to get them back militarily. And you can't trade them. So there was only one move. It would have taken tremendous courage and leadership on behalf of Israel. But when you know the story behind Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, you realize that they are nothing but trophies to terrorism, and that their story is exceedingly embarrassing for Islam. I write all about it in Goddamn Religion. I would encourage every Jew in the world to read it. I would encourage everybody in the world to read it. It's five volumes. All five volumes are now available on the yadaya.com website. I have risked my life to bring them to you. The least you could do is read them. Come to understand your enemy so that you can be free of their terror. And in the process, come to know the difference between Allah and Yahweh. Now, once one knows that the whole basis for Al-Aqsa Mosque was Muhammad being incredibly stupid and immoral. You see, the history that precedes the story of that mosque is as follows. And what I'm going to tell you is incontrovertible. There is no other interpretation of this episode. This is precisely what happened, and it's all laid out in the Quran and Hadith. Muhammad engaged in what I call the never-ending argument with the Quraysh. They were in Petra. Mecca didn't even exist at the time. And in that argument, Muhammad always lost. The Quraysh knew that he was demon-possessed. Muhammad admitted as much. They knew that he was a money-grubbing, vicious soul, and that his Quran recitals were nothing more than plagiarism. All true. And they said it openly, and it's recorded 400 times in the Quran. And so one day Muhammad just got tired of losing the oral debate. He was a messenger whose message was rejected by essentially everyone. That he looked up one day after a verbal critique, and he said to his extended family, "I will bring you slaughter." Because I will kill you. I will slaughter you. Well, that got their attention. You know, this guy's claiming to be a messenger of one of their, in fact, at the time it was Ar-Rahman was his god. That was the Arabs in Yemen, today's Yemen, Samarians at the time. Who were converts to Judaism. Because Judaism won't say Yahweh's name, they replaced Yahweh's name with Rahman, meaning the merciful. And so he named his god Rahman initially and was promoting Rahman. You find surahs in the Quran devoted to Rahman that says that is God's name is Rahman, and Rahman does this, that, and the other thing. And so he was there promoting Rahman, and they mocked him. We don't even know who that god is. We've got 360 gods and goddesses in the Kaaba, all with their own rocks. And you claim you're speaking for this dude. We don't even know who he is. And so Muhammad responded, "I'll bring you slaughter." So the Quraysh said, you know, maybe we can appease him. So there's a whole negotiation among the Quraysh, and it leads to them saying, "Okay, Muhammad, we know what your deal is. You want sex, you want power, you want money. The big three. And we're here prepared to give you all three. We'll make you king for a year. We'll add your gods to our gods. You add our gods to your gods. We'll all be one big happy family. And we'll give you a whole boatload of money." Yeah, it wasn't a boatload, but a camel load of money. Muhammad accepted the deal. So you have the idolatrous indulgence, which is you take this quote-unquote monotheistic religion honoring Rahman, and now you add the three main goddesses, the top goddesses of the Kaaba, to that list, and Muhammad goes off and he begins a Quran recital by claiming that Manat, Al-Uzza, and Alat were goddesses along with his god. Wow. And so his father-in-law, is the time he was 60-some-odd years old and he was convorting with a 6-year-old, that's not only pedophilia, it's grotesque. Yes. So it was his father-in-law that said, you know, I might take my little daughter back and not let you play with her anymore unless you renounce that, because you didn't cut us into this deal. Muhammad never did cut anybody in that he didn't need to bribe. And Muhammad renounces the idolatrous indulgence by saying that Satan made him say those things, and every one of his God's messengers speaks for Satan right there in the Quran.
Some prophet.
We all speak for Satan. Satan made me do it.
That sounds familiar. Where have we heard that before?
So, after that, he is now mocked incessantly, saying, "Oh, yeah, right." Now he's even admitting that his Quran recital comes from Satan. And according to the Hadith, there were only four followers left. Probably includes his adoptive son, who was once his wife's slave. So he didn't really have much choice in the matter. You had his father-in-law. That was the father of his little toy, Aisha. You had himself.
This Abu Bakr.
Yeah, Abu Bakr. Yeah. And you had a couple of other hoodlums. And that was it.
Okay.
According to the Quran, that was it. Everybody else left.
Wow.
So he was in quite a pickle. He was a religious leader without a religious following. And
no good for him.
So he needed a new plan. So the Kaaba wasn't working out very well for him. So he gets up one morning and tells his 6-year-old toy, child bride, that he had been to Jerusalem. And he went to the furthest mosque, and that Gabriel had brought him a winged ass, a donkey mule with wings, and he had flown the coop and gone to Jerusalem, and there he was the big-time imam, and he was the prayer leader with all of the bigwigs of Hebrew history. Yep, and he led them in prayer, and then... he and the winged ass jumped up into the sky to find Allah, and their first step along the way, of course, was hell. And according to the hadith, it was filled with women who were hanging by their breasts because they weren't appreciative of their husbands. And there he met his adoptive son, Zayed's wife, he says, and fell hot in lust for her. He would later steal her, which means that he also engaged in incest. And then he looked up to the seven heavens, meeting with everyone from Adam to Moshe and Abraham and, of course, Esau, which is the Quranic Jesus along the way. Finally gets up to Allah. And Allah says, what in the hell are you doing here? All I want is you to moon me and do that prostration thing 50 times a day. That was the sum total of the meeting. And he comes back down and he tells Aisha, yep, that's what I did last night. Well, I must be special. And she says, don't you dare tell anybody that. If you tell people that, they're going to think you're even crazier than they already think you are. Don't do it. Well, he went out and did it. And the night's journey made it into the Quran. I said, yeah, they don't believe you, but, oh, yeah, I took him there. Really happened. Furthest mosque, Alaska. That's the story. And it became so bad that they laughed Muhammad out of town. And on the way out of town is when the Pledge of Aqaba took place, where 20 renegades, malcontents from Yathrib, decided that they would trade morality for babes in paradise and for booty. And Muhammad told them that in his religion, they could rape, they could steal, they could enslave, and they could keep 80% of what they stole, so long as they pledged to wage war on all mankind on his behalf. And that was the first year of the Islamic era. So once you know the story of Alaska, and you tell that story nationally, in your media, from politicians, everyone, telling that same story, it's all laid out for you in goddamn religion, every detail of it. Tell that story. And then you tell the Muslims in Gaza that raped your women and tortured your children and abducted your people. You return them tomorrow, or I will destroy Alaska Mosque. And if that doesn't get your attention,
keep going.
We'll go another day, and you don't return them, and I will destroy the Dome of the Rock. And if that doesn't get your attention, the following day, I will take bulldozers. And East Jerusalem, where you've got Muslims hanging out claiming it's their city, anything that is remotely close to Jewish habitations, I will bulldoze.
Mm-hmm.
We want to play this game? We'll play this game. But we're going to play it our way. And that's what I would have done. And even if you didn't get any of the 200-some-odd abductees back, you'd have changed the dynamic entirely. The third thing is what I've shared earlier. You have to make using the term Palestinian illegal. That's a criminal act because of its consequences to Israel.
Right.
It would make just a tremendous difference. The next thing I said is that you must publish everything that occurred. Every sweet, loving picture of every child and young man and older person that was abducted or murdered or tortured or harmed in any way, and their life story must be told, and then every image, no matter how grotesque, of what happened to them, including the entire story and the forensics on what happened to them, needs to be told, and needs to be told completely and boldly. And if you think, oh, that's just not us, we would never cause the remembrance of those people to be shown that way, then you allowed them to die and to be tortured for nothing.
Right.
As opposed to making their lives meaningful, such that the world could not deny what Islam does, what Islam is, how savage it is. You want to promote it, then you are on the side of promoting a religion that has sexually mutilated 250 million little girls, where women have no rights, that will celebrate rape and kidnap, pedophilia. This is Islam, and you needed to deal with it that way and to show it that way if you were going to survive any of this. These are the things that Israel had to do. It did not do any of them. And so Yahweh, recognizing that, provided Israel with its consequence. Now, as we share this, and we're going to begin, actually, where we left off last week, which is really a high note. It's on Yahweh's return and the restoration of the covenant. And the reason we're going to start off on this high note is not only where we left off, but the story for a remnant of Israel ends well. It's just that for the vast majority of Jews and for the world at large, it ends very poorly. And so you need to know what to expect along the way. So we're going to share it with you. Now, mind you that there are times where Yahweh directly intervenes in human affairs. They are few and far between. Yahweh has only intervened once in the past, 2,000, almost 2,000 years. He intervened with Dodd in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim.
Mm-hmm.
Intervened 22 years ago on Teruah to ask me to do this for you. And he has deployed his seven spirits to make it possible for you to know what we're going to be sharing and have been sharing with you. But for the most part, the chosen people chose not to associate with God. And relationships don't work if they're not reciprocal. So God essentially said, and Hosha, I want you to marry a temple prostitute so you understand what it's like to be married to a religious whore like Israel. And you'll understand why I'm announcing that I'm divorcing Israel. This was circa 700 BCE, just prior to the Assyrian onslaught. And in this particular case, this was not the beginning of a fractured relationship. The relationship with Israel was very nearly impossible to resolve during the Exodus, 1447 BCE. During the entire Exodus, the Jews were miserable, irascible, antagonistic towards God. And it was during the Exodus that Jews specifically said, we don't ever want to hear from you again, God. Don't ever speak to us again. God says, hey, you got a deal. I've tried this. You aren't any fun at all to be around. I don't need this aggravation. And fortunately, I will find just enough people along the way that are willing to listen to what I have to say that will share with you what you need to know when you need to know it. So we will communicate that way. And that's the only way we're going to communicate. But Jews have, with the exception of very few moments of quality relationship, you know, very few moments under Dode, for example, when he united Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel into one kingdom. And even then, you know, there were coups and riots and all manner of horrible things happening among the Jewish people. So that wasn't even harmonious. And you had a brief harmonious moment under Hezekiah, which was at the time of Hosea's writing, where they found a copy of the Torah, decided that they needed to stop being religious, destroyed all the religious artifacts in Judea, and observed Pesach, Matzah, and Mukurim, which Jews wouldn't even know how to observe today. They figured out how to observe it, but couldn't do it in time, asked Yahweh for an extension of time. He gave it to them, and they observed it late and had so much fun doing it, they said, let's do it again. And at the time, Israel had their backs up against the wall, something that God has learned about his people. There were 185,000 Assyrians camped out, ready to besiege Jerusalem, and they would have killed every Jew. And Yahweh eliminated them. Now, consider that, 185,000 of them, and they've recently archaeologically found evidence of all of this to demonstrate it. And, of course, on a Syrian stele, there is affirmation of this, going back to this time of Jerusalem being surrounded but not penetrated. That you compare that to 3,000 terrorists entering Jerusalem, and actually not Jerusalem, but southern Israel, and creating such havoc that the world now is poised to isolate Israel, and the destruction of Israel is imminent. 3,000. Yahweh eliminated 185,000 without Israel firing a shot. He didn't do it after the fact. He did it before the fact. The difference between trusting God and not trusting him, but of course the Jews immediately remembered who they were and forgot who Yahweh was and went about being religious and political again and have been estranged from God ever since. But God says that's not going to continue. We will, on a future program, get to something I wrote 2 days ago that was one of the most difficult things I've ever committed to writing. And it one whole day, what I wrote, I ended up pushing way off to another chapter, and I said, that's not going to do it. And finally, one morning, when my mind was fresh, I said, I think I can write this down. But what I shared was the reason Yahweh had no choice but to pick a goy to do this. And what was at stake when Israel went bad, and why there was no chance after 3,500 years that Israel would have attended and participated in the Shavua harvest, Teruah harvest, been there on Kippurim or Sukkah. And if there's no one to harvest, why bother? If there's no one to return to, why return? If there's no one to reconcile, what's the point? Which means the entire human experiment would be for naught. The Torah has no value anymore. The covenant is over. The Mikra don't matter. The earth is destroyed. Quite frankly, everything revolves around us prevailing. I had to come to grips with, and as I say, I want to share this with you as I wrote it because I'm much more articulate in writing than I am extemporaneously. But I had to come to grips with something that has been nagging at me for years now. That is, Yahweh has a lot of clever explanations of the role that I'm playing to awaken his people for these final harvests in his return. You know, there's things like Choder, which is a secondary branch, Nakar, which is an observant foreigner, Nakri, which is my observant foreigner, Bashar, which is a herald, in-person herald, Malak, which is a messenger, an Ed, which is a witness, Kol, which is a voice. He uses the name Yada in reference to myself and what we're doing. He speaks often of Yada Yahweh, which is is how we operate. It's the overriding title of not only the website, but all the books that we have written in this program. But there's one title that has really bothered me. It's Zoroah. And it's really the title that led to all of this. I really had no concept that Yahweh had called me to do this, or that he had announced that he was using me to do this. I was very happy writing anonymously, and guess what name I picked, of course, Yada.
I remember.
What name I picked for the title of my books, Yada Yahweh, duh. Okay. So I was played in a very nice way. God has a sense of humor, so, you know, what the heck. So I was doing, I was living my life, going along, just thinking I was anonymous, and I had the greatest job in the world. I got all of the benefit and had no responsibility, and I was learning stuff no one had ever recognized before, and was here in this amazing pageant of words, translating the Torah and prophets and Psalms from the oldest extant witnesses, particularly the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I was learning things that no one had perceived in thousands of years. And then I ran into a problem. The problem was the definition that I had used of Zoroah from the beginning no longer worked. Well, it did, but it didn't work everywhere. Zoroah is defined in the Torah as the sacrificial lamb. That's why the rabbis, when they have their Seder, throw a Zoroah, which they think is just a lamb bone, on the plate. The Zoroah is the sacrificial lamb. Well, come to find out, that works beautifully of Dod, and he is the ultimate Zoroah, and Yahweh is very clear, like in the 89th Mizmor, saying he's a Zoroah. Dod is the sacrificial lamb. He's the savior of Yisrael. He's also the Messiah and Son of God. And then come to find out, there's another Zoroah, Moshe. Yeshaya calls Moshe a Zoroah. Well, I get that. He was the strong arm of God. He was leading the people, leading the flock as the lead ram out of Mitzrayim to the promised land. I give you. Yeah. Moshe.
Yeah.
He's my guy. No one in all of human history measures up to Moshe. And so you've got the two greatest men who ever lived, the two most important men who ever lived. They're both Zeruah. I'm really cool with that. And then I read, you know, in Yeshayah 53 in the preamble, it says that Israel, you really need to pay attention. If you want to understand this role of the sacrificial lamb and the whole story I'm about to tell about the sacrificial lamb, you need to listen to the person who figures out who the Zeruah are. And no one had been calling Dode a Zeruah. They don't even call Dode Dode, much less the Son of God, Messiah, and our Savior.
Yeah.
And no one had figured out that he served as the Passover lamb, and therefore he really is the Zeruah. And there's no one who has done that who has also celebrated what Moshe had to say, particularly what Moshe said in the 18th chapter, which is just so profoundly important for this message, is the person that is addressed is Dode. He's the one. And, of course, it's also the same book where Moshe explains how you tell a real prophet from a false one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come to find out, not only Moshe, but others, Yeshayah, and Solomon. In his introduction to who the was going to speak to the people, he used the term Nakre, observant foreigner. He said, too, there's a third Zeruah. Moshe explained there was a third Zeruah. I'm the third Zeruah.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't fathom myself, Yisrael, in the role of somebody beside those two men. I'm not worthy to untie their sandals. And so while I'm obviously the weakest link among the three, I'm still in the short list of those three, and I'm trying to say, how can that be? Why would Yahweh do this to me? You know, don't put me in that company. I can't measure. I can't live up to that. Now, that's way, way too much to ask of anyone. And that's when I figured out that, well, without Moshe, there is no Israel. They would have all died off in Mitzrayim, Egypt. Without Moshe, Yahweh would not have had the conduit through whom he revealed his Torah, his plan, the nature of the covenant, the purpose of the Moed Mikre. Without Dode, there is no united Israel. There is no Jerusalem. There is no Temple Mount or temple. Without Dode, there's no exemplar of the covenant. Without Dode, there's no Messiah. There's no Son of God. Without Dode, there is no one explaining how to properly observe the Torah. But that's not the whole of it. Without Dode, there's no fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. There's no eternal life. There's no means of perfection. There's no way to enter the covenant family. Dode volunteered to do these things. And so Dode is essential to God's story. He is the returning Messiah and King. But there's no one for him to return to.
Without?
If I don't do this job. There's no one else doing it. Yes, we have a covenant family now, and many are exceedingly helpful. I mean, devoted to this cause, deserving enormous credit for their love of Yahweh and his people and his mission to awaken Israel. But with Yahweh, there's always one, and he is the person that Yahweh speaks through. In this case, I am the coal, the voice. And I came to realize that should I fail, Everything is for naught. The Torah doesn't matter. The Exodus doesn't matter. The Mikra are unfulfilled. Yes. Zod has nothing to come home to. There would be no Shavuah harvest. There hadn't been a single Yehud or Goyim who had come to know Yahweh, listened to him, understood his message, his timing, and future history. Since, well, the last of them was Malachi 2,500 years ago. None. Nothing had changed. No matter how bad it got for Jews, they didn't listen. You know, Christians went off and completely covered up everything Dode did with their false Messiah and false Son of God, false Savior, plastered over the truth. Rabbinical Judaism did everything they could to deny that Yahweh and Dode had done these things for Israel. No one was listening. And if no one is listening, there is no Shavuah harvest of prominent and mature grain. There is no Teruah harvest of olives of Yisrael and Yehudim. None. And there is no one to return to on Yom Kippurim, and thus no reason to return. It's all for naught. So I may be the least satisfying of the Zeroah, the least qualified of the Zeroah, the least credentialed of the Zeroah. But Yahweh solved that. You know, with Moshe, he was there with him every step of the way. With Dode, the moment he was first anointed at 8 years of age, Yahweh said that his spirit came upon him and never left him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't have much to work with in Yada, and so he applied all seven spirits, emboldening him, giving him insights, intellect, capacity to get this job done. Seven spirits. Unprecedented. It's only one time it's ever happened. I'm not taking credit for succeeding in this endeavor, because God stacked the deck. He made certain that I would succeed. Well, I still have free will. Didn't force me to do this. But once I accepted, he made certain that I would be able to do this. And what you're witnessing in these 35 books and these thousands of audio programs is the result of Yahweh's devotion to his people to awaken them and call them home. And Dee, you have been studying the Shavuah, Teruah,
yes,
and Kippurim fulfillments, as I have been, and I'm here to tell you, the story from Yahweh is consistent.
It is. Very.
Very
consistent.
We succeed.
Yeah.
There will be tens of thousands of Goyim and Yehudim who will be harvested on Shavuah. You know, it's a wheat harvest, and it's wheats plural, and there are two loaves of bread and multiple varieties of wheat representing all the various peoples of the world.
Yep.
And it's going to be a grand celebration. Yahweh calls the people who avail themselves of Shavuah harvest. This is May 22nd, 2026, exactly 7 years. Well, it's exactly 40 months to his return. He calls those individuals mature and prominent. They
right.
Stand up. They're accounted for. They're making a difference. These are the people who made a choice to be part of the covenant, to attend the Mikra based upon what Yahweh had revealed 3,500 years ago. Their backs weren't up against the wall. They made the choice because they took the time to know Yahweh, came to respect him, understand what he was offering, and accepted what he was asking in return.
Yes.
And so these individuals are mature. They're prominent. They stand out. They're making a difference by devoting themselves to awakening others. The second harvest he speaks of as being infants. They're very young. And that's the reason for that, this olive harvest, is that, well, the fact of the matter is that the most mature member of that group will be 3.5 years old.
Yeah.
In terms of their development.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last group, he calls suckling infants. Because at the oldest of them is going to be 10 days old in terms of their spiritual development and understanding of the Torah. They will have made the right decision, but not have been able to grow much based upon it. And so we know we are going to prevail. Yahweh has seen our future. He knows the choices that are made. He knows that we have devoted ourselves to this. For example, even though Amazon deserves our great disrespect and disdain, hatred, really, for disallowing the printing of Yahweh's message, one of the great crimes that has ever been perpetrated, we will end up with a much better result. And
that's
it's Yahweh's
true.
Responsibility to make this happen, and he's going to work this through, and we will end up with a better result. And our job has always been to make the information available and to share it with as many people as we can. And thankfully, he brought us David. And thankfully, he brought us Jackie and Dee and Kirk and Leah and so many others who are devoted to sharing this message. Steve, Mike.
Yes.
So here we are, and I'm going to begin again in Yeshayah, or Yirmiyah, 31:31. This takes us to the preeminent event, really, in human history. And there's only up to this point 5 dates that could even compete with it: the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. But those were very, very dark days for father and son, Yahweh and Dod, because of the pain and the sacrifice, and particularly because of the great agony of having Yehudim and Israelites all disavow what Dod had done, and to do so for 2,000 years. The great pain of being rejected after having offered such a wonderful gift at such a tremendous price. And so while the Shavuah harvest will be a grand celebration with Yahweh as the covenant family comes home, and the Teruah harvest also a celebration as there are a significant number of Yehud and Israelites that returned to Yahweh during the conclusion of the time of Jacob's troubles. And this leads then to a wonderful celebration of the return to a completely reconciled family on Kippurim. And that is the day that is being discussed here. Behold, the time is coming, Yahweh reveals, well in advance of it occurring, when I will enter into and cut with the house of Yisrael and with the family of Yehudah a restoring and renewing, repaired and affirmed covenant. Now, as we shared last week, This cannot have anything to do with Christianity or their New Testament.
Absolutely not.
And it can't have anything to do with Judaism.
Absolutely.
A time is coming, not that G-D, not Hashem. Behold, a time is coming that Yahweh reveals. When I, Yahweh, will enter and cut with the house of Yisrael and with the house of Yehudah, eliminating any chance of Christianity. Not with Goyim, not with the church. A restoring and renewing, repaired and affirmed Bereth. There is no original covenant in Christianity. There is no celebration of the covenant or understanding of it in Judaism. This is a Torah-based concept. The next statement is, it will differ somewhat from the covenant which, to reveal the way to the benefits of the relationship, I entered into with their fathers on the day I took them by the hand and with overwhelming intent overpowered the situation to bring them out of the realm of the crucibles of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
As I shared with you last week, but it bears repeating. The difference in this nature of the covenant that is going to be reaffirmed with Yisrael and Yehudah is it is distinct from the application of the covenant during the Exodus. He's not comparing it to the time that he affirmed the covenant with Abraham. Because quite simply, there is no difference to that time, because Yahweh even affirms that he gave Abraham his Torah. And if he gave Abraham his Torah, since there wasn't a written Torah, he placed his guidance and instructions inside of him. So there was no difference between the renewal of the covenant and the original covenant with Abraham. The difference is between the way that God interacted with his people in this relationship during the Exodus, where he will explain in a moment what that one difference is. And he said, relationally, they broke my covenant, although we were married. Yahweh reveals through his prophet. Now, what did Yahweh do that was different? It's one word. Chazak. I firmly took them by the hand and with overwhelming intent overpowered the situation.
Right.
God gave you the answer.
Yeah.
He didn't say the difference is a new covenant based upon the gospel of grace. He didn't say that's the easy way, you know. All you got to do is believe. He didn't say that renewal is a billion rabbinical laws and a Babylonian Talmud. No. He said the difference is with the children of Israel, as I tried to remove them from the human oppression that they were enduring in Egypt, knowing that they did not know me, knowing that they knew nothing of the covenant and of the Torah, and that was their normal. That's what they had been in that condition so long, they knew nothing but slavery. Life for them was slavery. And the idea of being free of that was frightening to them. I talking with Leah about the consequence of being in a family where the mother is suffers from borderline personality disorder, is that you're constantly either being destroyed or controlled. And because that's your mother and it's constant, you then, and she pretends to love you and claims that this is, she's doing all this because she loves you, you begin to equate being controlled and destroyed with love.
Right.
And so when you seek a spouse, you seek that which you defined as love, and you, and it's a never-ending cycle. You know, my father was abusive. I, unfortunately, in my first marriage, married an abusive woman. And it's very difficult to break out of that cycle. You know, both of my boys have been consumed by that. It has defined who they are. And it's very common. And in this particular case with Yisrael, I can appreciate God's predicament. That's all they knew. That's how life was defined. And so for them to be in any other circumstance was not life. And so God said, I had to yank them out of there, kicking and screaming. I had to literally grasp them by the hand and drag them out. Otherwise, there was going to be no Yisrael. That means the covenant would be for naught. There would be no Torah. There'd be no basis for any of this. The whole human experience would be literally for naught. I had to respond this way. This wasn't a matter of them choosing. Do you want to go or not? I drugged them out. Well, the renewal of the covenant is not going to be that way. There will be enough people who choose to be with Yahweh, who will read Yada Yahweh, who will listen to this program, who will visit the social media sites promoting all of this, listen to the audio programs that we are making with visual content, and they will choose to come to Yahweh. They will return home. They will cease being religious and political, and they will become part of the covenant family. But it will be their choice, not God dragging them this time. And so God says, for this reason, this is the covenant which to enjoy the benefits of the relationship I will cut with the house of Yisrael after that, and then without hesitation, prophetically declares Yahweh, I will provide placing, giving my Torah, my guidance, my teaching, instructions, and directions within them, in their midst. And integrated into their ability to make decisions on their hearts, I will write it. I will be their God, and they shall be my family. This is the conclusion of the story. It ends as it began. Now, one of the things that came to realize, and I think that we all need to be cognizant of. All of the early characters in God's story, Adam, Chawa, Noach, his wife, his sons and their wives, Abraham, Lot, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Yishak, Jacob, Leah, Rachel. Not a one of them was Jewish. Not a Yisraelite among them. And so everybody at the beginning of God's story, first 2,000 years, you do not have a single Jew. Then God chooses to reveal himself through these people and to form a covenant relationship with them. But in the last 10 years, why would we not expect Yahweh to come full circle?
Right.
And just as he started with non-Israelites, include them into his final picture, particularly as a witness, recognizing that he is still going, thank goodness, there's an opportunity for all of us, that he's still going to focus on his people.
You know, I had a thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the purpose of being set apart was to be an example to who? There can only be one set apart people, but the people
mm-hmm.
that they were supposed to be guiding were Goyim, if the Goyim would pay attention and wanted to participate. And
mm-hmm.
it's interesting
yeah.
that Dod and Moshe paved the way for you to come along. And what better assertion that Yahweh means that anyone is welcome into this, should they be
mm-hmm.
thoughtful and approach correctly, than to appoint a Goy to do the end time role of Zeruah. You know, this is a family. This is a
mm-hmm.
family covenant agreement. That's my little rant, but it makes
no.
sense.
Yeah. It's Jews were given the opportunity, Israelites, to be the shining example for the world.
Right.
To be the prophets to the world, to be God's voice to the world. But
yes.
they stopped listening to him. They didn't want to listen to him. They told him, don't even talk to us anymore.
Yeah.
And they stopped speaking for him. And so rather than Yisrael being the example and guiding Goy, you know, I said, all right, anyway, if you're not going to do the job, I'll have a Goy guide you. It's all the same place. You know, it's my family, my home, my rules. This is what we're going to do. Now, we're not saying that we want to accept the ways of the Goy. And matter of fact, this Goy is going to be overtly anti-religious, anti-conspiratorial, anti-political, anti-military. So we're not going to accept the ways of the Goy, but it is a Goy that's going to call my people home.
Right.
Because they were unwilling to do it. So it is coming full circle. But in this particular statement, you have zero chance. So this is the one statement, the only one, that gives any potential credence to the idea of a new covenant and therefore New Testament. And it absolutely obliterates the possibility in every possible way, from the original audience, Israelites and Yehudim, to the God's name, Yahweh, to affirming that it's about your people's experience, and speaking of the Exodus, speaking of them breaking the covenant, but that very same covenant being restored with them, and then speaking specifically about the reintegration of the Torah into their lives, not the Talmud, not the New Testament. It's in one statement that is so essential to the most popular religion in the world, it completely destroys it, while also giving no safe harbor to Judaism. Marvelous.
Yes.
Yahweh is so clear in what he's offering. And the reason that we're in this position, well, we'll be here in less than 10 years, for Yahweh to take an external document, most important document in the universe, this external document called the Torah, God's teaching and direction. And to take that document is something we can choose to accept or reject, to cover over in the case of Christianity, or to replace in the sense of the Babylonian Talmud, where rabbis have far more influence than Yahweh. They won't even say Yahweh's name. They give lip service to the Torah and then call their trash Torah. What an insult. And so God's solution is, I'm going to now incorporate the Torah inside of you. Why? Because everyone at this point will have chosen to be part of the covenant family. We will all long for this. We don't need to have it out there as something we can choose to accept or reject. And now that we've chosen to accept Yahweh on his terms, all of the people here, whether they were harvested on Teruah, on Shavuot before it, or on Kippurim, and entering now the millennial celebration of Sukkah, we all need guidance. We just do. We're going to be elevated to seven dimensions, with each of those dimensions requiring so much more greater comprehension and understanding of what's at stake. And at this point, we don't want to be wondering about things. We want to know them.
Yeah.
Right.
And so God is going to incorporate his guidance right into the core of our being, into our heart, which is the seat of judgment, so that we can make sound decisions going forward. But even then, there is still a big job to do, because you have the majority of those who are harvested on Shavuot have been part of the covenant family and have known Yahweh on average less than 10 years. Those who are part of the Teruah harvest will know Yahweh on average less than 2 or 3 years. And those who are on part of the remnant reconciled on the day of reconciliations, Kippurim, will have known Yahweh for days.
Right.
So there will be a lot of catching up to do and a lot of teaching to do at this time as well. But the Torah will be integrated inside of us, and so we will have so much more going for us. And in this particular moment, too, we've talked about this previously, but the big difference, too, is that this Torah is a little t. You know, in Hebrew, there's no such thing as capitalization or lower and uppercase letters. They're all one case. So the whole idea of capital Torah versus lowercase Torah is a symbolic concept, not an actual reality in Hebrew. But the difference is that Torah as a title is the name of the books, that first four books that Yahweh shared with Moshe, and the fifth one that Moshe derived from those four books and his experiences with Yahweh and shared with God's people, being Dabarim words. That those five books contain enormous amounts of hurtful information. Information mm-hmm. we need to know. We need to know how antagonistic humans have been towards man, and how God all along has had this intent of having a loving and engaged family, doing things together with his children and empowering them and enabling them. And so that is the Torah, but because of the nature of it, with its first condition to walk away from Babel, from the intermixing and commingling confusion of religion and politics, from Babylon, from your country, and from the family of man, God has to explain the nature of religion that he is separating his people from, and the hurtful conditions that existed in Babel, for example, that existed with the Nephilim, who were overtly terroristic and religious and political thugs necessitating the flood. What then happened in Mitzrayim, where slavery and mass murder prevailed. And then what happened on the Exodus, where the children of Israel continued to be antagonistic and embittered and religious and ungrateful. So within the Torah, there are lots of things that are sad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason for us to be saddened going forward. Everybody that will be part of God's family will have chosen to be there. None of us will be religious. None of us will lack for understanding. None of us will be political or militaristic or conspiratorial. And so there doesn't need to be a warning about those things. We're just here to be guided on the possibilities
mm-hmm.
that exist. So I think this Torah is teaching, guidance, directions, and instructions on how we move forward as a loving and productive family.
Wow.
So that is what God is offering. That's where it, and that's actually not the end, but that is the high note right prior to the end of the story, because the end of the story is Sukkah, where we camp out in conditions that are identical to those experienced during Eden. And yeah, it was very clear, even in Yoel, that the earth is being reconstituted as Eden, as man has come to within a whisper of destroying it and annihilating life on the planet. God is going to restore it to those conditions. And so it's very important that we understand what transpired in Gan Eden, the Garden of Great Joy, and how Yahweh and Adam interacted, what they did together, and what existed there, what didn't exist there. Very important to understand that, because that's where we're going back, to a non-religious, non-political environment. We have a firsthand relationship with Yahweh, and get to celebrate life together. So as a kind of recap of what we have read thus far, that in this first statement here of this message, it was directed to Yisraelites and Yehudim. As we progressed, the audience was reaffirmed when God spoke of your fathers being brought out of Mitzrayim, and then the identity of those slated for restoration was conveyed as Yisrael. Therefore, the prominent and preeminent pronouncement required by Christians to justify their New Testament shared clearly does not apply to them. By the same token, with the incorporation of the Torah into the lives of God's children, the Talmud Toters are also excluded. In fact, so are all of those who are political and religious, because the stated intent is to become children in Yahweh's family, where there are no parties and no sex. I did say sex, not sex. We think that we'll still be able to enjoy one of God's great inventions, but there will definitely be no religious sex or political parties. My diction isn't always that good, and I just wanted to clarify it, although you did get a kick out of Talmud Toters, as I thought you might have been when I wrote
it. I did.
Yes. Should you wonder why Yahweh, and I think I've shared this, but it bears repeating, can integrate his Torah guidance into the lives of his covenant family at this juncture but could not do it previously? The answer, of course, is free will. Had God sought to place his Torah inside of Yisraelites 3,500 years ago, it would have been against their will. And it would have precluded anyone from rejecting him, which is completely incompatible with a loving relationship. However, now that every recipient has arrived at their own discretion and chosen to be directed by the Torah, that's how they have arrived here, it is the perfect adjunct to guide us through the expansive realm of space-time and from being trapped in time in three dimensions into the seventh dimension of Shamayim. I was listening to a program the other night, I think it was last night, that what happens if you accelerate to the speed of light? And I was just mind-numbed by how much changes. Everything changes. Perspective, time, vision. It's there is nothing that stays even remotely the same. And recognizing that you're still a three-dimensional object, which, of course, can't be accelerated all the way to the speed of light. But the thing that Yahweh is offering us is to empower us taking us from three dimensions to seven, with each step along the way being infinite in terms of its capability. So this is really an extraordinary trip that he is going to take us on, and we are going to vastly more processing power too. We're all going to have supercomputers. I won't use the term artificial intelligence because all of my experience with the so-called AI has been horrible. Those who have programmed it have programmed it to be progressive and to be absolutely senseless. So please don't miss the fact, and I don't think we've allowed you to miss the fact, we've harped on this every which way, that the Torah is literally being written inside of us. Written inside of us. Now, that is a direct jab at the absurd rabbinical argument in favor of their oral Torah. They claim that their Talmud is an oral Torah that was given to 70 Jews at the time that the written Torah was given to Moshe. Well,
the 70 elders that wouldn't go up?
Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. Everything you read in the Torah precludes any possibility of there being an oral Torah. But in this particular case, Yahweh is writing his Torah inside of his children. God has a overwhelming preference for the written word, just as I shared with you when I was trying to explain the nature and the importance of the role that we are performing on behalf of Yahweh's people and Yahweh himself and for his son, Dod, who would not be known for what he has done without this effort. I said, I'm going to try to explain it to you extemporaneously, but Melody, you're much better off listening to the written word. It is much more thoughtful, insightful, compelling, articulate, motivating, reliable, inspiring, and also dependable. Yahweh is a very adept programmer, and he's going to write his Torah inside of us, just as he has written life inside of us with DNA. It's a written language.
Right. I think it'll be coded into our DNA.
Yep.
I think so.
So further to this point, since Yisrael's long-anticipated return to Yahweh culminates with the incorporation of Yahweh's written Torah, there would have been no validity whatsoever to a New Testament or to a Talmud. God's message has not changed. His people have.
Right.
As a result of the restoration and integration that Yahweh intends, there will be a marvelous transformation, the complete elimination of religious, political, and conspiratorial jargon. We will all yada Yahweh. No longer will anyone impart information or teach individuals in association with an errant and outspoken world or other individuals according to brotherly kinship, so as to say, choose of your own accord to know Yahweh, because everyone will know me. And up from the youngest and up to the enduring witness of the most important and oldest, prophetically reveals Yahweh. That's God's plan. It will not change. So now you know what's going to happen, with whom, when, and why it will occur. So I trust you will be among the celebrants returning to this God of ours who is so devoted to his family. Now that we've explained where we are headed, I want to return to Hosea. We're now in the sixth chapter. Hosea is a marvelous portrayal. Just like is Yoel, just like is Yashayah, of the lifespan of Yisrael. And in it we find God's plan and how it's going to unfurl over time. He writes in Hosea 6:1, you should choose to go because we should return to Yahweh. For he has torn us away for a time so that he can heal us for all time. He has thrust us aside, but he will wrap himself around us. Now, let's be clear. Yahweh did not tear a loving family away. He tore away those who were repulsive around him, who had rejected him away. He did not thrust observant and responsible covenant members aside.
Right.
Push the religious away.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, these statements were all written under the auspices of free will, of volition. You should choose to go, halak, of your own volition. You should walk and explore, being willingly led, because we should return and be restored. Wah, shub, el, since it is in our interest to turn around and change. You want to return to Yahweh? Shub is the operative word.
I love that word.
You must change to be restored. You want to return, change direction. You're going the wrong way if you're political, if you're religious. You're heading away from God. In Judaism, they love to talk about halakha, the walk, the way. It's kind of like the Mandalorian. This is the way. Well, in Judaism, it's a corruption of halak. Unfortunately, they're walking away from God.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to find him. There's only one way to walk. It's through the Moed Mikre, beginning with the doorway of Pesach, which Dod, our Savior, the Messiah and Son of God, opened for us. And over that threshold that perfects us of matzah, unyeasting our souls, the fungus of religion and politics, so that we can be part of Yahweh's family on Bukurim, empowered and enriched by him. And this, of course, this path leads to the next harvest that will be fulfilled of Shavua, demarking the beginning of the worst of Jacob's troubles in May 22nd of 2026, just 2 years from now. This, of course, leads to Teruah, the harvest of the ripe olives of Yisraelites and Yehudim, so that the prophecies that we just considered in Yirmiyah, Jeremiah 31, are fulfilled on Yom Kippurim, enabling us to camp out with our God, him to wrap himself around us as we camp out with him, healed for all time. So you should choose to go, halak, because we should return to and be restored by Yahweh. For he has torn us away for a time, expelled us, chased us away, and banished us, so he can heal us for all time, so we can promote restoration, cure our diseased and injured state. He has thrust us aside, but he will wrap himself around us. You know, the divorce decree and Hosea for bad behavior is in the second chapter. And God speaks of the timing of coming back also in that, towards the end of the second chapter. So by the sixth chapter, he's now talking about the consequence of all of this. And of course, it's in the fourth chapter that you have that marvelous statement of, because you have forgotten the Torah, I have forgotten you.
You, yeah.
That you know, Israel has destroyed itself over a lack of knowledge, for a lack of knowing.
Right.
So he has torn us away for a time so that he can heal us for all time. He has thrust us away, but he will wrap himself around us. Hosea, he provides. Hosea 6:1. It's your life, of course. It's your choice. Because a relationship with Yahweh is subject to free will. It cannot be imposed upon you. We are not back in Mitzrayim with God dragging his recalcitrant children out kicking and screaming. This means if you want to be with God, you need to prioritize reading, learning, understanding, and then responding. Those who do will find Yahweh waiting for them with open arms. Now, both of co-hosts on this program have benefited from this very thing. Kirk has devoted countless hours over these last 6 to 8 months creating a glossary of terms so that the words that that Yahweh has used now can be looked up individually so that you know their meaning. It gives the young neophyte translator an opportunity to do this work and to better understand what Yahweh has to say. His words define him, and they define the way home. And Dee has used them not only to create the timeline, but to come to understand the nature of these upcoming harvests and the role that we're playing in enabling them. But both Kirk and Dee have done their study by examining the amplified translations and commentary and insights that are provided through Yada Yahweh. And I share that with you because if you're listening to this program, you can do the same. It's there for you. And because it's all in writing and all online, you can read it. If you question a definition, you can copy it and paste it into your favorite browser and search for explanations and verifications. You can use the tools that are available on the Yada Yahweh site to do it. But this is all available to you. It's all available free. It's an enormous wealth of information, beautifully laid out and easily retrieved, whether it's on a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop or a desktop computer. No matter where, what device you're using, it reads beautifully.
Yeah.
So you have this opportunity. And unfortunately, for most of the past 3,000 years, Jews have been halakhing, but in the wrong direction, becoming more religious and political. And they're busting at the seams in religiosity and political diatribes today. And that's why they were pushed away. That's why the vast preponderance of Israelites have remained estranged. And this must change to come home. We should also be cognizant that Yisrael and Yehuda are not being invited into the home of Adonai, nor Hashem, nor G-D. Likewise, the Lord Jesus Christ and the Quranic Rabbi Allahi Hahu are nowhere to be seen. There is no mention of Akiba or Maimonides, Peter or Paul, no Muhammad, no hint of a Talmud, New Testament, or Quran. This journey is through words. It travels back in time to the formation of the Bereth and the conveyance of the Torah and forward through the fulfillment of the Mikra and the revelations of Yahweh's Nabi prophets. The chosen people are being called to halak, walk with Yahweh, and to shub, return to the covenant, and be restored. As a vine dresser would do in a vineyard, the diseased and rotten trindles will be pruned back so that the vines can be restored to health. It is a time for healing, for vibrant new growth, in a disease-free environment, all to spring forth as new life. Love and fellowship will replace anguish and infidelity. Yahweh's remedy for the consequence of religion, his means of restoring his relationship with those who abandoned him 3,500 years ago, is Pesach and Matzah, just as it was on the Exodus, leading to Bukurim, Shavuah follows for the covenant family, comprised of Yehudim and Goyim. And then for those who missed these fulfillments, the final opportunities are to ruin Kippurim for the final remnant upon Dod's return so that we can all enjoy Sukkah. In each case, the first two mikre result in the third. And while all of that is true, this particular prophecy depicts what will occur as the final three moedim are fulfilled in the seventh month of the Yobel year of 6000 Yah. We'll end our program tonight with this citation from Hosha He Saves 6:2. Through 2 days, he will choose to revive and sustain our lives. On the third day, he will establish our restoration, encouraging and raising us so that we can stand and endure. Then we will live in his presence. There is so much to unravel and unwrap in this prophetic gift of Hosha 6:2. I dare not start it with 2 minutes left before Blog Talk Radio says goodnight. So I will say goodnight to Dee, to you, Kirk, and to all of those listening who are part of the Covenant family, and to all of those in Yisrael and Yehudim throughout the world who Yah was calling home, and also to Goyim who wish to embrace the Torah and Yahweh and be part of his eternal family. We wish you a wonderful Shabbat and a good night. We look forward to being with you this time next week. May Yah bless you all.
Good night, Yah. Good night, Dee.
Good night, Kirk. Night, Yada.
Good night.
Hey, you like good stories, right? Well, there's one you just have to experience for yourself. A city with heart and soul, spirit and light, about a city where everywhere you look, you catch glimpses of a bright, shining movement. In the photos along the walls of local eateries, in the voices and sounds reverberating through the music venues, and on college campuses and in the Civil Rights Museum. It's the story of Jackson, Mississippi. See how the city with soul shines at LetItShineJXN.com.
When it comes to Botox, choose the one you know, Weiler Plastic Surgery. We're a national top 20 Allergan provider with multiple locations to serve you. Book your same-day Botox appointment today at WeilerPlasticSurgery.com.